Amen. Why? It's probably the question that is asked more than any question in human experience. It's a question that is being asked right now in Afghanistan as people ask, why has the earth opened up and swallowed something like the last number I heard, around 1,000 people? Why does a young man at 18 years of age go into a school and kill children and teachers? Why do a young couple, sit at a hospital bed and hear the news that perhaps nothing can be done for their dying baby daughter? Why does a dear sister in our congregation have to go through multiple episodes of chemotherapy and cancer care? Why do members of our congregation go through years of debilitating pain and suffering? And I'm sure that there are many here, even this evening, or who are watching online, who are asking that question about some or other experience in their own lives. Why is this happening to us, or why is this happening to me? That is a question that was also in the mind of Job and his three friends, or so-called friends, and also in the mind of Job's wife. And you see that as we read this passage, as we have read this passage, Job is not privy to what is happening or what has happened behind the scenes, as it were. We, as the readers of this account in biblical history, are taken behind the scenes, as it were, and shown some of the background in verses 6 through verses 12, and in the early verses of chapter 2, we read of a conference that took place in the spiritual realm, as the sons of God and Satan with them come into the presence of the Lord, and the Lord engages in a dialogue with Satan and asks him the question, have you considered my servant Job? Job is none the wiser to this. Job is never made aware of this event which has taken place in the spiritual realm, either in this chapter or in the chapter to come. Job is left to wonder, why are these events happening to him? Why do good things, or why do bad things, happen to good people, was the title of a book written by a Jewish rabbi in the last century. Why? Well, there is an answer. There is a short answer, and that answer we find in the details that Job is not given. God is why. Because God is ultimately the author of these events which will be brought to bear in the life of Job. And they are indeed for a purpose. There is nothing wasted in God's economy. Even the most intense suffering, and every Christian, I would argue, at some point in their lives, or perhaps even all the way through their Christian experience, will experience some kind of suffering to one degree or another. And God has good reasons for this, because ultimately it does glorify Him and exalts His name. There's three things that I want us to look at this evening as we consider this first chapter. I would take my text the last three verses of the chapter. Then Job arose and rent his mantle and shaved his head and fell down upon the ground and worshipped and said, "Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And in all this, Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly. We're going to seek to answer why Job could come to such a conclusion. And so there's three things that we want to look at here. The first thing that we want to look at is Job's character. And secondly, Job's crisis. And thirdly, Job's conclusion. Job's character, his crisis, and his conclusion. First of all, Job's character. What kind of man was Job? It's important for us to know that, because that helps us to understand what gave Job the ability to reach the conclusion that he did and to be able to stand up under the intense suffering that he did. We can read in our text from verse 1, from God himself, or from the writer to this book. We don't actually know who wrote the book of Job, but whoever it was, tells us that Job was a perfect and an upright man, one that feared God and eschewed or shunned evil. Again, we can read in verse 8, "And the Lord said unto Satan," the Lord himself said unto Satan, "as I considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil." And again in chapter 2 and verse 3, the Lord himself again says to Satan that Job is a man who is upright and eschews evil. So twice God makes this statement about Job, and once the writer makes the same statement. If you want further detail to that, you could turn to chapter 29 of Job, and you would find there a detailed description of the character Job. Some of the things that are mentioned there is that Job sought out the poor and the needy to help them, that he spoke wisdom, and that he cared for his family. In modern language, we would say that Job was a godly man who feared God and walked with God and kept his law. He was perfect and upright. He feared God and he shunned evil. He was above reproach. He was a kind of man that nobody could find anything against. You would never be able to catch Job off his guard, because he never needed to be on it. According to God, in verse 8 again, he was the most righteous man in the East, the most righteous man on the earth at that time, the godliest man who lived in that time. And he showed all the signs of the fruit of the Spirit in his character. This is what would stand Job in good stead amidst the trials that would come upon him. He was a man who had experienced the grace of God. and it showed in his character. It showed in how he responded to adversity and testing. You see, it's usually our reactions that define us rather than our actions. Our actions are usually predetermined by ourselves, and we do a good job of presenting ourselves as we want to be perceived by others. You know that if you are married this evening, or if you are dating this evening, if you hope to be married, that when you're dating your spouse-to-be, you always put your best foot forward. As a young man, you might take 45 minutes to iron your shirt before you go out on your first date with your would-be girlfriend. If you're the young lady, you will spend more time doing your hair than you will when eventually you're married. You put your best foot forward. You're very careful not to say the wrong thing or to present yourself in any kind of negative way. But eventually, the truth will come out. But you see, Job's character showed in how he responded. It wasn't his actions that defined Job. It was rather his reactions. Because our reactions are unpredictable. They're unpredictable in the circumstances that will eventually come to betray who we really are. This came clear to me recently as I was listening to a speaker who came to the chapel in our in Zion Christian School. And there's a sports program that happens in the school, and he used that as an illustration where he talked about, you know, supporters from a sports team will go to a stadium to support their team, and depending on whatever's happening in the stadium at any given time, that person will betray what they're really like. And there was one man who came to the speaker after he spoke, and he said that when he was watching his favourite sports team, that he became someone different from who he is. And the speaker turned to him and said, no, you become who you are. And he was right, because that's who the person really is. It's our reactions that define us, and it was Job's reactions to his adversity, to his trial, that really defined who he is, who he was. How would you react in a crisis such as Job's? How would you react in a crisis such as Job's? Would you fall into despair, to depression, or would you take the advice of Job's wife, who said, curse God and die? How would you react in the same kind of circumstances? Well, let's look at the circumstances. Let's look at our second point, Job's crisis. There are four mind-numbing and cataclysmic and overlapping events that must have shocked Job to his core. Can you imagine receiving the news that an enemy has killed all of your employees, stolen your livestock, not once but twice, and then to be told at the same time that two natural disasters have occurred that has wiped out the remainder of your possessions and all your children? How would you react in such circumstances? Job had gone from being the richest man in his community to being a pauper. He's made utterly destitute, just at the stroke of a pen almost. He is absolutely nothing. He's been reduced to nothing. He even loses his friends who came to supposedly comfort him, and who draw the conclusion that Job must be being punished for some sin and abandoned by God. Even his life partner, his wife, tells him that he would be better off dead. He's totally alone, totally destitute. He has nothing. Everything is gone. He's forsaken by all and appears to be abandoned by God himself. Everyone around Job is drawing conclusions about his plight, that somehow God is bringing retribution against him by taking everything away from him. You know, we need to be careful. We need to be careful about the kind of conclusions that we draw when God is bringing circumstances into another believer's life that might bring about similar circumstances. We need to be careful about drawing conclusions. I remember a young man a number of years ago going to an elder in his church and saying that God felt distant from him in his prayer life, and the elder retorted to him, "Well, you must be harbouring some sin in your life that God has withdrawn himself." Well, that may be the case, but it wasn't the case in this case. The case was that God was withdrawing himself in order that the young man might pray more. God doesn't bring retribution to the Christian. He might use suffering as discipline in our lives, but it's never for retribution. It would be just as easy for us as it was for Job's wife and his friends to draw the wrong conclusion about his plight. His friends thought he was being punished. But not all hardship is directly related to sin. And for the Christian, and this is important for us this evening, I think, hardship and trials are never punishment for sin. We need to get that this evening. Hardship and punishment for the Christian are never punishment for sin, ever. Why? Because God never punishes sin twice for the same crime. If you're a Christian this evening, your sin has already been punished on the head of the Son of God. And you will never be punished for any sin that you have committed or will commit. You may be disciplined. God may bring discipline and will bring discipline into your life for your sanctification, but he will never punish you for sin. And for us to think that God would punish us for sin would be an affront to God, to think in such a way, because it betrays a misunderstanding of Christ's propitiating death for that sin. God never punishes believers for their sin. He may bring those circumstances to discipline, but it is never punishment. That is the wrong conclusion to draw. So what was Job's conclusion? You see, Job understood that his sin had been forgiven. He was a righteous man. God himself declares him to be a righteous man. That means that Job had been given a righteousness which is not his own. That's how he could be declared righteous. And so Job's conclusion was the correct conclusion. That's our third point. Verses 20 and 22, which is through 22, which is our text this evening. Job's conclusion. This was his conclusion. Even though he did not see or hear anything of the conference that had taken place in the spiritual realm between Satan and God, Job recognized one thing. Job recognized that it was God who had given him everything that he had, and that it was God who had taken it away. And he even blessed God for taking it away. Verse 22 tells us that he did not sin or charge God for his calamity. Even though he recognized that God had removed everything from his life, he was not bitter. But you see, even in the midst of this terrible affliction, Job knew something else. There was something else that Job knew here. He came to an even greater conclusion. It's a conclusion that he comes to after this conclusion. You see, this is really not Job's conclusion. It's not his final conclusion. He came to an even greater conclusion than his view of the providence of God in all things. Job understood the providence of God, but he knew something else. In chapter 19, verses 25 and 26, it states there that Job knows that his Redeemer lives and that he will see him in his flesh, in his resurrected flesh. You see, Job had a long-term view. He's looking forward to the incarnation and the resurrection. Job's faith in God is never shaken because he has a right view of God's sovereignty and providence. There may be other lessons for Job to learn as his suffering increased, to include painful sores on his body as he sits on an ash heap and cuts himself to bleed out his sores. Those lessons are for a different time in a study of Job. But what we need to see this evening is that Job is a type that points to the Redeemer he speaks of, who will stand on the earth in the future. One who also will experience undeserved suffering at an even deeper level than Job did. You see, Job experienced the absence of the felt presence of God in his trials. But the Redeemer of which Job speaks, he knows he will see in the future in his resurrected flesh. This Redeemer will experience an abandonment that Job never experienced. Job experienced an absence of the felt presence of God, but he was never abandoned by God. But this Redeemer would be abandoned by God. You see, God does eventually reveal himself to Job in ways he had never known in the last chapter of Job, in the last chapter of the book. And he was restored with a double portion of all that he had lost. But Jesus' cry of dereliction from the cross went unanswered. And he was assigned to a death that Job would never experience. Nothing that Job experienced came close to the spiritual anguish that Jesus felt, because Job was never punished for his sin. Jesus was punished in Job's place for his sin. His Redeemer was punished, and Job saw this. Job experienced discipline. It was harsh, but it was not directly related to his sin as punishment. It couldn't be, because he was declared righteous by God. Job knew there was a long-term conclusion. His conclusion in chapter 1 was a short-term view. But he knew his God, and he knew that God knew him. And his faith may have been shaken a little, but his anchor was firm. He says it in chapter 19, "I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that I will see him stand upon the earth on the last day." And so the question this evening is, for us, is your anchor firm this evening? Even in the midst of severe trial, are you assured that the author of your trial is God himself, who is honing you and preparing you for heaven? Can you say this evening with Job that you know that your Redeemer lives and that you will see him in resurrected flesh on the last day? The furnace of Job's affliction was God's furnace, and he was controlling the temperature. And God knows how hard it needs to be to burn off the impurities that remain this side of heaven. God's furnace of affliction was Job's ultimate blessing, because his restoration is typical of a heavenly future. But the final question is, or the final statement needs to be, it's better to be in the furnace of affliction than in the curse of the fire of judgment.